From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United Nations General Assembly on Thursday morning voted 128-9 against Donald Trump's declaration of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. The vote was a strong rebuke not only of the U.S. decision, but also of threats issued by Trump and his U.N. representative Nikki Haley. The General Assembly vote follows an earlier vote by the Security Council on Monday on a similar resolution, which the U.S. lost 14-1. Trump responded to the Monday Security Council vote saying, quote, "For all these nations, they take our money and then vote against us. They take hundreds of millions of dollars, even billions of dollars, and then they vote against us. We're watching those votes. Let them vote against us. We'll save a lot. We don't care." End of quote. Ahead of the General Assembly vote, Representative Haley sent a letter to UN members saying the president will be watching this vote carefully and has requested I report back on those countries who voted against us. We will take note of each and every vote on this issue. She then followed her letter with a tweet publicly. "When we make a decision," she wrote, "at the will of the American people about where to locate our embassy, we don't expect those we've helped to target us. On Thursday, there'll be a vote criticizing our choice. The U.S. will be taking names." Well, here is what Haley said to the UN General Assembly on Thursday morning ahead of that vote, which the U.S. lost 128-9.
"America will put our embassy in Jerusalem. That is what the American people want us to do. And it is the right thing to do. No vote in the United Nations will make any difference on that. But this vote will make a difference on how Americans look at the UN and on how we look at countries who disrespect us in the UN. And this vote will be remembered."
And that is Nikki Haley, the United States representative to the United Nations, speaking on Thursday morning ahead of a General Assembly vote on the Jerusalem issue and making what many see as a mafia-style threat to the United Nations. My guest is Phyllis Bennis. She's the director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, the author of numerous books, including Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror, and Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan. She's a longtime UN expert. Welcome to the program, Phyllis.
Thanks very much. It's good to be with you.
So first, this has been a very sort of strange and twilight zone type of period at the United Nations, it seems, just this week with the Jerusalem votes, first in the Security Council and then in the General Assembly. But essentially, this is what Donald Trump promised, right? He made very clear that he was going to have his way at the United Nations and he would simply do what he wanted to do and the rest of the world be damned.
Very much so. This was what he promised for his base. This is partly to satisfy his right-wing Christian Zionist evangelical base, and partly to satisfy a couple of his key funders, most notably Sheldon Adelson, the multi-billionaire pro-Israel casino magnate, who were demanding that he talk about moving the embassy and go ahead and do it. So, as you say, the rest of the world be damned. What we got today was this extraordinary General Assembly vote that was a real message to the United States saying, it was not very pretty. It's saying, you are more isolated than you realize. And this was very important because despite all of the threats, President Trump, of course, had threatened to cut aid to any country that voted against the U.S. Nikki Haley, the U.N. ambassador from the United States, had made these sort of schoolboy bully remarks about we're taking names of any country that votes against us. Despite all that, there were only 9 votes against, and 4 of them were the small island states that are completely by law dependent on doing what the United States wants them to do on foreign affairs. So Palau, Micronesia, the Marshall Islands, and Nauru were 4 of the 9. 2, of course, were the United States and Israel. And then there were 2 Central American countries, Honduras and Guatemala, plus Togo. That was it. That was all the opposition. So all the threats didn't work because there was this kind of global unanimity that the Trump administration is way out of line here. Now, we should keep in mind, Sonali, this is not the first time that U.S. officials have made these kinds of threats against either Security Council or General Assembly members when they're threatening to hold countries accountable if they don't vote with the U.S., that sort of thing. In fact, the language that Nikki Haley used was very similar to language that was used a few years ago by the Bush administration, George Bush Jr., in 2003, the day before the war in Iraq began. The U.S. sent a message to the members of the General Assembly using very similar kind of bullying language, where they said that we were going to take names and that this issue is very important to us. Haley's statement today was, I want you to know that the president and the U.S. take this vote personally. It was almost the same language. So this is in some ways an old story of the U.S. The difference is we heard directly from President Trump himself, we don't care. That was his language. We don't care, when he was talking about what the impact might be of cutting aid to countries who might have the temerity to vote against the U.S. We never heard a president say that before. We don't care what happens to these countries, some of them some of the poorest countries in the world. So this is an extraordinary example of U.S. absolute bullying at the United Nations, and the United Nations pushing back and saying, you're not going to bully us. We're not going to give in.
Now, how much does Donald Trump misunderstand about the role of U.S. aid internationally? Because the story that he has spun to his base is that we give all of this money to all of these countries at the U.N. and then they don't do our bidding. They don't conform to what we want. Why are we giving them all this money anyway? And he doesn't even say that about just aid. He says that about the fees that the U.S. owes to the U.N. Does he misunderstand how it works?
Oh, I think he understands quite well how it works. I think this is a political point for his base. Mm-hmm. He's building up anti-UN sentiment. He's building up right-wing nationalism that is based on isolating the United States from every part of the world. It's a kind of isolationism that, we should note, does not apply to military engagement. The U.S. is more than willing to send bombs against Yemen, to bomb Syria, to send drones. That's all okay, but when it comes to economic aid, for instance, clearly there should be a quid pro quo. They should have to vote with us. Every country, every wealthy country in the world sends a far bigger percentage of their GDP in international aid and assistance than the United States does. Mm-hmm. So this notion that the U.S. is somehow getting a raw deal is something that Trump is simply making up. It's not about how he understands it. He may or may not understand it. That's really not very important. What's important is this is a concoction designed to shore up his right-wing base against the United Nations, against anything remotely internationalist about being part of the United States.
Right, because they see international law as something that threatens U.S. power. How significant are both the Security Council and the General Assembly votes? I had mentioned in my introduction that the votes were a rebuke, not just to the U.S. decision on Jerusalem, but in a way a rebuke to the mafia-style threats. Would you agree?
Certainly, and particularly, I would say the General Assembly vote was that. The Security Council vote was a really important example of just how isolated the Trump administration has made the United States. The United States is now an international outlaw. It's a rogue state in the minds of governments and certainly people all across the world. And it's not to say that there hasn't been antagonism to the United States at the UN before. It's a long story. I wrote my first book on U.S. domination of the U.N. back in 1995 in the era of the supposedly internationalist Clinton administration. But it was an old story, and it still is. But this is taking it to an entirely different level, where you have language like, we don't care what happens to these countries. So what we're seeing here is a not just a rebuke, but a very steadfast rejection of this kind of bullying. The vote was 128 countries voting for the condemnation, voting directly against this Trump move around Jerusalem. Only 9 countries voting against. There were 35 abstentions, including some close U.S. allies like Australia and Canada. The white settler colonial countries came in defense of the U.S. and Israel, the other white settler colonial countries. But they didn't get it. They didn't get it.
And is that level of abstention pretty common, or was that a little high?
It was a bit high, but not terribly so. Most of the Europeans supported the resolution, did not abstain. I don't have the full, the list just came out and I haven't had a chance to go through it yet, so I don't know all the countries that abstained. But I do think that this is well within the normal range. It's a little bit high, but not very high. But having 128 countries who voted yes in the face of that kind of bullying, those kinds of threats, which we should note the U.S. has made good on those threats. In 1990, when the U.S. was desperately trying to build up support for going to war against Iraq in what would become Operation Desert Storm, there were two countries that voted no. One was Cuba, that voted no on principle. The other was Yemen, the only Arab country on the Security Council, and it could not vote to authorize the attack on another Arab country. Yemen voted no. And no sooner had Abdullah el-Ashtal put down his hand, the Yemeni ambassador, than the U.S. ambassador was at his side saying, that will be the most expensive no vote you ever cast. And sure enough, 3 days later, the U.S. cut its entire aid budget to Yemen. Now, it was a pittance of an aid budget. The poorest country in the Arab world, it was only getting $70 million, nothing close to what they needed. But cutting it was a huge symbolic effort. And it was picked up on an open microphone. And it was clearly designed to intimidate other countries. At that moment, nobody cared very much about Yemen. But this was a message to every other country. You cross us on something that is important to us at the United Nations, and you will pay a price. And they saw that the U.S. made good on that threat. So the fact that this time around, 128 countries said, threaten all you want, we're not buying it. That's huge. That's really important.
That's the world calling the U.S.'s bluff in a way. And I'm wondering if this move is being seen with dread, not as much by the Democrats, who of course don't like this, but even by some of the Democrats and Republicans have often been bipartisan on foreign policy with some major differences, but foreign aid is often seen as a way to leverage U.S. power internationally by the U.S. now having its bluff called. Isn't the U.S. left much weaker, particularly from a pro-war hawks perspective, much weaker internationally with much less clout, possibly driving all these countries in the arms of Russia and China?
Well, one would hope that this would drive countries not into the arms of any other superpower, but into the arms of independence.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't the first time that the U.N. has stood up in the run-up to the Gulf War in 2003. The members of the Security Council, famously known as the uncommitted six, the six relatively poor U.S.-dependent countries, Angola, Cameroon, Guinea, Pakistan, Chile, and Mexico, all were prepared to vote no. They kept saying, we are not going to vote with you. We are not going to vote with you. And on the day of the global mobilization against that war, February 15th, 2003, the U.S. withdrew its resolution from the Security Council, realizing it could not get the support of these countries despite enormous threats that were made against them. So there is a history, but it doesn't happen very often. So the fact that it is now being reclaimed, that history is being reclaimed at the United Nations, means that the U.S. ability to manipulate, its ability to bully, its ability to browbeat and threaten other countries is, as you say, significantly reduced.
On the ground, there has been, of course, tremendous opposition both among Palestinians, but even in the global community, a lot of pro-Palestinian movements around the world have denounced Trump's decision to declare Jerusalem the capital of Israel. In many ways, this UN vote bolsters those kind of movements as well, right?
Absolutely. It puts together what we once called the second superpower, the linkage between global social movements, some governments acting often for their own interests, but despite that, in concert with those global movements, and as a result, the United Nations. That's what can create a second superpower to challenge the one superpower that defined itself militarily, that being the United States.
If Trump does cut off aid now to, we were sort of joking at work today that Nikki Haley must have been very busy taking names since there were 128 of them that voted against
Indeed.
the resolution. If the U.S. makes good on its threat to cut off aid, where does that leave the United States internationally?
Well, it shows once again how isolated the United States now is under the Trump administration. Ironically, some of the aid that gets spent by the United States could well be reduced without a problem because much of it does not go to the poorest communities who desperately need that aid. Levels of corruption, the degree to which U.S. aid far too often is based on providing military aid to countries that don't need a bigger military, they need a bigger level of support for their population, and they don't often get that from the United States. So there's a way in which it may not be as desperate as it sounds, but it is a very awful thing to contemplate that when the wealthiest country in the world, the country with the biggest economy in the world, stands back and acts like a bully on a playground, saying we're going to take our toys and go home, our toys being our willingness to share a little tiny bit of foreign aid with you, we're going to just stop doing that because we're mad at you. You didn't vote with us. This is very dangerous. This is playground style bullying for the most powerful country in the world, and it's only going to have the result of further isolating the United States and weakening U.S. ability to influence anybody.
So basically, just as Trump has had massive temper tantrums domestically, he just had a global one.
This is a global meltdown. This is a global meltdown, and boy, is a timeout needed desperately.
Phyllis, one of the other pieces of news coming out of the Palestinian territories, out of Israel, because all of this is happening in the context of the U.S. essentially clearly now backing the occupier. It has always backed the occupier, but doing so much more overtly. One of the stories coming out about it is the arrest of a 16-year-old girl named Ahed Tamimi, who has been held by Israeli forces. We don't. This is a young girl in a sort of prominent Palestinian family, and her father, in a court appearance, was also now detained. We're just not seeing very much news about that. But this is a kind of context that it would do our media well to apply to the story of the Jerusalem decision, right?
Very much so. And the situation facing Ahed Tamimi, who is a child, she's 16 years old, she is now facing what Israel has, is the only country in the world that has a juvenile military court system where children under the age of 18, from the age of 12, can be held and are often picked up at 2 o'clock in the morning from their homes in the occupied territory, taken away by Israeli military forces. Parents not told where they're being taken and not allowed to accompany them. In many cases, brutalized, beaten, in some cases, tortured, and forced in some cases to sign confessions in Hebrew, a language that none of these children understand well enough to know what they're doing, let alone the idea of making a child sign a confession in any language, without their parents, without a lawyer, without any assistance. It's the only country in the world that allows that, and there's a very important resolution pending in Congress right now that was introduced by Congresswoman Betty McCollum that calls for the United States to be sure that no military aid, the U.S. of course spends $3.8 billion of our tax money every year on a direct grant to the Israeli military, that none of that money is used to support this horrific illegal system of having children be in the custody and the jurisdiction of a military court. So that's now pending. There's more than 20 co-sponsors already. I'm not sure when it's going to come up for a vote, but that's something that people should definitely be looking to urge their own members of Congress to support that resolution.
And of course, since we are discussing foreign aid and the leverage that the U.S. has over other countries through foreign aid, the foreign aid to Israel is the biggest piece of the foreign aid pie, which doesn't get discussed nearly enough by either the press or politicians.
Absolutely right. The Israeli grant now is $3.8 billion a year. It's on a 10-year-long agreement that was orchestrated by the Obama administration. And that grant not only is bigger by far than any other country, it's more than twice as big as the next the next biggest grant. It all goes directly to the Israeli military. None of it even has the pretense of being economic aid. It's all to the military. And unlike the military aid to any other country, Israel is the only country allowed to spend a quarter of it on its own military industrial complex, if you will, competing with the United States. So whereas most military aid around the world acts as a kind of corporate welfare for military producers, for military corporations in the United States, the aid to Israel acts as giving our tax money directly to Israeli military corporations and enriching their shareholders and their CEOs while producing military goods that are being used to kill Palestinians and to be killing people all around the world as they export those weapons. So it's a dramatically horrifying situation when we talk about that kind of military aid. This, as you say, does not get talked about in the press or among politicians.
So finally, Phyllis, what's next on the story of the Jerusalem move? Will the U.S. simply go ahead and move its embassy into Jerusalem? Presumably, of course, Israel is only too happy to comply with that. And if it does so, you know, we talked about the U.S. not having much leverage left, but other countries in the world doesn't have much leverage on the U.S. if it wants to simply go ahead and carry it out.
Well, that's possible. I think that we should also note that when Trump announced this, he did not say, and as of tomorrow, we are putting up a sign at the existing U.S. consulate in Jerusalem, declaring it to be the embassy. That's really all they would have to do if they wanted to make it symbolic. Okay. He announced, we're going to build the biggest and the best and the most beautiful new embassy. We're going to buy new land, and it's going to take years. So he, in fact, signed the six-month waiver once again, what he said he didn't want to do, saying it's just going to take a long time. It may well never happen. This is all about the symbolism, all about the optics.
Like his border wall with Mexico.
Very much so, very much so. There are issues about who owns the land where the U.S. wants to build a, quote, embassy. So it may well never happen. The damage was done with the recognition of Israel as, the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Whether it goes further to actually physically build a new embassy, Trump might not even be president by the time that could happen. It takes a long time.
Well, Phyllis, I want to thank you so much, as always, for sharing your insight with us and for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Sonali.
Phyllis Bennis is the director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, author of numerous books, including Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror and Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan. She's a longtime U.N. expert. We've been discussing the latest U.N. vote condemning the U.S. for declaring Jerusalem Israel's capital. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.